Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey friends, it's Ken Carmen.
And Anthony Lima.
Did you know that the Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima is both a radio show and a podcast?
You can find us anytime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods.
Catch the full episode, listen by the hour, or jump straight to the highlights.
Just open up your favorite podcast app, search our names, and hit the follow button to get every minute of the show.
Your way and on your time.
Big week for the Browns, maybe not for the game against the Steelers, but for the franchise, certainly. And to join us talking about it, Odyssey NFL insider Brian Baldinger, host of the Best Football Show podcast. Insider Calls brought to you by Nationwide for your insurance and financial needs. Nationwide is on your side. Brian, thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, good morning to you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's been a wild week. First, you got a rivalry game with the fans coming up Sunday against Pittsburgh. They just traded Greg Newsome away last night. He was your starting corner. They'll bring in Tyson Campbell. I'm not sure how quickly he can get acclimated to this. After that, and then the Joe Flacco trade earlier, is that too much of a distraction for this football team to actually go out and play well on Sunday against Pittsburgh?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, Flacco wasn't going to play anyways. As long as Dylan Gabriel was healthy, he wasn't going to play. So he's gone. I don't think that was a distraction anyways. I mean, he was a veteran in that room, the quarterbacks. I think he was an important one. The Newsome trade is a little bizarre to me. I mean, he's really a really good player. I mean, obviously losing Emerson in training camp really hurt. But defensively, they played very, very well. And Newsome's a part of that. And I thought he was playing well. I don't really totally understand the trade. Tyson Campbell is a good player. He's a big corner. They're having a lot of success taking the ball away in Jacksonville. Maybe it's just something that both teams feel like benefits their team. And I don't think that's a distraction. But, you know, I mean, it's playing for Jim Schwartz's defense is fairly complex. I don't know how quickly he can be up to speed right now.
Boy, it is fascinating to see, like, you're seeing different kinds of trades today in the NFL. You know, we have the deadline obviously coming up in like 3 weeks, but the Browns have a GM that's not afraid to mix it up and also trade somebody to a team that we are monitoring closely because we own their first round pick.
They've already, you know, done that deal. So there's familiarity. James Blackstone, Gladstone is the general manager of the Jacksonville Jaguars. He's very young. Andrew Berry, of course, in Cleveland. I mean, they've gone back and forth to make that deal, you know, right, you know, the day of the draft. And so they've got a familiarity. They know each other's phone numbers. You know, when it comes up and they see 216, I think Gladstone probably, I don't know who initiated the call. I don't know much about the players' contracts between Newsome and Campbell. I'm not sure about any of that kind of stuff. It's just an unusual trade. Two starting corners that are, you know, basically cornerstones for two good defenses right now. It's really kind of unusual to see anything like that happen. Right now, you know, Jacksonville is a top 10 defense. Cleveland is as well. So it's just a little bit unusual right now.
Brian Baldinger joining us, Odyssey NFL Insider. Insider Calls brought to you by Nationwide. For your insurance and financial needs, Nationwide is on your side. Bruce Arians, former NFL coach, obviously knew him. He was on ESPN, Pat McAfee show, kind of went after Kevin Stefanski earlier this week. And, you know, the job he's done, 4-18, the last 22. You talk, obviously, to a lot of people in the league. Brian, what is the rest of the league telling you about Kevin Stefanski right now and the job he's doing with the Cleveland Browns? Are they still pro Stefanski?
So I'm a big Bruce Arians fan. I've known him a long time. He was, I mean, all the way back to his coaching days at Temple. And he's got a Super Bowl championship. But I'd like to see what Bruce Arians would do with this roster right now. And all the rookies that are out there, would he Would he be winning a lot more games, or all the turmoil that Stefanski has gone through? Is that a fair criticism? If any coach, Belichick, Bruce Arians, Don Shula, give me a coach that would handle the situation that Stefanski has handled with as much turnover and upheaval as this franchise has had. I don't know if anybody would be successful. So, am I defending Kevin? Yeah, to a degree. But I would defend any coach that, I don't care what their last name is, if they had to, endure everything that's going on with this franchise right now. And the fact that they're competitive, they had a good chance to beat the Minnesota Vikings, which is a very good team with a franchise that was in the playoffs a year ago. I don't know. I mean, they're competing pretty well. I know that. And that's kind of a sign of, coaching, I think. They've been in a lot of these games. Going back to the first game against Cincinnati, they should have beaten the Bengals that day. They could have beaten Minnesota. So they're competitive at least at this point.
But see, I'm telling you, Baldy, anytime we've tried to defend Kevin, and I'll admit it's getting harder when you think about the numbers that are going out there, the 17 points or less in all these different games. Like, eventually it is a results league. So, how do we reconcile that?
I don't know. The running back didn't go through any of training camp, but he's your starting running back. He had a legal issue he had to handle. The quarterback makes his first NFL start. I don't know. He's a third round pick. I don't know how many guys are supposed to win their NFL debut as a third round pick in the history of this league. I don't know how many, win that debut. The tight end is a rookie. The middle, your guy calling the signals on defense, a rookie. Your defensive tackle's a rookie. You're trading away your starting corner. Your best corner got hurt in training camp on a non-contact injury and tore his Achilles. All those things are real. The best quarterback you've ever had is leading the Tampa Bay Buccaneers to another division championship. So, I don't know. Okay, go fire the coach. And what are you going to do? And who's coming in here to fix it? I don't know. You could defend him or not defend him. It doesn't matter. Who's going to be successful in this atmosphere right now?
By the way, do you think Baker Mayfield would be having the same success had he stayed here in Cleveland?
No, heck no. No, the franchise needs stability. You need good draft picks. You got to build, year to year. Nobody is probably drafted better than the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They've got stability with Todd Bowles. The offense coordinator changes every year, but Baker's is in a team with the best left tackle in football and a Hall of Fame wide receiver and great young players around him and a first round center that looks like he's going to be a Pro Bowl player every year. And a defense that knows how to take the ball away. He wouldn't have this success in Cleveland, but he's got real stability and a real organization right now. Cleveland's trying to get there, but they're not there right now.
All right, so Dylan Gabriel, the rookie, and Baldy join us right now on the hotline. This is amazing stuff that he is giving us because he's giving us a defense of Stefanski. So I'll ask you, rookie quarterback, it was a very conservative game plan in the opener. Not a lot of throws past 10, 15 yards. What did you think in his debut?
Well, what receiver are you going to throw to beside Judy? Who's out there? They don't have much. But I would say that, you go down there and you have a lead at some point, 17-7, whatever it was. You run a 2-minute drill and put a field goal up at halftime before the half to go up 10-7. I don't know. What is he? Where are you supposed to throw it to and air it out with a left tackle that's, I don't know how many starts KT has at left tackle, and Jack is hanging on at right tackle. It's been a real issue for this football team, the tackle position. I don't know what quarterback is supposed to light it up against a very complex, maybe the most complex defense in all of football. You don't know who's coming from where in that defense. I don't know. I thought he played well.
Brian Baldinger joining us here on the show. So when do we see Shedeur Sanders, if we see Shedeur Sanders, to you? How would you handle this?
He's the backup quarterback. He lost out. He was hurt in training camp. He lost out to Dylan Gabriel. He's the starter right now. He's the starter until he either doesn't play well or he's injured. And nobody wants to see that happen. So he's like every other backup in this league right now. I know what his last name is, but he's the backup quarterback. And until Dylan Gabriel proves that he can't hold it and can't elevate this team around him, then Shador will get a chance. But I don't think there's any timeline for any of that to happen right now.
Judkins, to me, he really had a breakthrough last week, because not only did you see all the physicality and his ability to take contact, go forward, seeing holes, balance, all the attributes. He also had that speed last week. He was a game-changing running back, didn't you think?
Yeah, no, but I thought he was coming out of Ohio State. I thought he was an NFL-ready player. And, you know, I think Dylan Sampson is a good player. But Judkins looks pretty special. I mean, he's averaging almost 5 yards a carry, limited number of carries at this point. But, I mean, you know, the short yardage plays, he had a couple conversions, and then, you know, a couple that he didn't get done. But I thought he's off to a good start right now at that position. I mean, I don't think there's much room for, you know, Ford, you know, on this team right now, the way Judkins and Sampson has caught every single thing that's been thrown to him. So I thought they were very high on both running backs in the draft, and they are getting them on the field right now. And, and I think they're going to have, I think both are going to be good players in this league.
Have you paid, Brian Baldinger joining us here on the Fan Hotline, have you paid much attention to the Belichick saga at UNC?
Not really. I mean, it's just a difficult college. I'm doing a Oklahoma-Texas game this week down in Dallas, and I'm kind of studying college football a little bit harder than I normally would at this point. But it's a difficult situation if you don't have a good handle on the portal and how the money gets allocated and getting a good quarterback in there. I mean, if he had Drake May, he'd probably be winning a lot of games at North Carolina, but he doesn't have that right now.
All right, forget anything I just asked about Bill Belichick. I didn't know you were doing the Red River rivalry there, Brian. So let me go to John Mateer. Do you think he'll play on Sunday?
He called it the Red River rivalry.
I mean, the guy broke his hand. It's his throwing hand two weeks ago. I don't know how he finished the game with a broken hand. I don't know what bone it is. Can he grip a football? Like, I'm trying to figure it out because, it looks like it's pointing to him playing. And I've watched his backup, Hawkins. Last year he started 4 games. But Mateer is an elite athlete, and they're undefeated. And so I'm sure they want to stay undefeated. It's the biggest game they've played to this point, although, you know, the win against Michigan was really good, but it was early. I like Mateer. I hope he plays, honestly, selfishly. I hope he plays. But, I don't know how you reconcile being able to play with a broken hand at this point.
Oh, he'd be tough, I would say, as moxie. Do you believe that he is a future NFL quarterback? And if you were going to make a comp, who is his NFL comp?
I don't have a comp, by no stretch. Do I have a comp for him at this point? I mean, I've only really studied 2 games of his. I've got all day here to study a couple more. But I don't have a comp for him right now. I just think that, you know, physically he's got the tools. That, you know, he looks good when I just kind of study him. I mean, just he's not the biggest guy. He was at Washington State. Haven't watched any of those games. But, you know, he's 6'1". He's 225. There's a lot of guys that kind of fit in that mold right here. He still has more football left if he decides to stay. He's got another year if he wants to stay. So it looks like the talent around him. I don't think the offensive line is what I'm used to seeing at Oklahoma. But, you know, the running back, I think, is really good, Torrey Blaylock. And so he's just a freshman. I kind of want to see a little bit more of him before I kind of project.
That's fair and measured, and I respect you for it, because I was looking for you to say one name.
We were chasing something else
there,
Baldy.
Yeah, I was chasing something else. And also, my phone's lighting up. Guys, called...
Who's the comp you're chasing?
Oh, I think... Well, he doesn't know, but Baker Mayfield. I was hoping for Baker.
Okay. Yeah. There's only one Baker.
Damn it. Well, it feels like there's a curse now, and I got to lift the curse. Okay. Guys, I called it the Red River Rivalry. That's what they call it.
I wonder what Baldy calls it.
That's what they're supposed to call it now.
It's a bit of, you know, I lived in Dallas and played for the Cowboys. I mean, it's the biggest party of the year. You know, I mean, everything is bigger in Texas. Those parties this weekend, starting probably today, are legendary parties. I mean, that's a fun weekend. It's Fair Park, it's the Cotton Bowl. The state fair is the best state fair of any state fair in any country in the world. You know, you want to go look at some steers. You want to go eat some, you know, the best state fair food there is. Get fat over the weekend. This is the weekend to do it. But the Red River Rivalry, I mean, go back to Darrell Royal and, you know, Barry. I mean, this is legendary stuff now. This was Caleb Williams' breakout game. 3-4 years ago, I guess, you know, coming in there and taking over and you know, lighting up the scoreboard. So, like, the history of this game is the history of college football. I can't wait to get to Dallas tomorrow.
Brian, we thank you very much for the time. Enjoy your time in Dallas, and we hope to talk to you again very soon. Thank you very much.
Okay. You got it, guys. Yep, take care.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Hi. Brian Baldinger, Odyssey NFL Insider. Brian Baldinger, host of the best football show podcast. Insider calls are brought to you by Nationwide. For your insurance and financial needs, Nationwide is on your side.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Hey friends, it's Ken Carmen
and Anthony Lima.
Did you know that the Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima is both a radio show and a podcast?
You can find us anytime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods.
Catch the full episode, listen by the hour, or jump straight to the highlights.
Just open up your favorite podcast app, search our names, and hit the follow button to get every minute of the show.
Your way and on your time.
We go to the fan hotline. He's one of our favorite guys to have join the show. He is the chief bottle washer at Pro Football Talk. Mike's created an empire there. Well, he's been writing books. The big shield is out. He's Mr. Mike Florio. Hello, Mike.
Hey, guys. How are you today? Thanks for having me again.
Hey. Well, we appreciate having you. The big shield's doing some big things. What's going on?
Well, 99-cent ebook, one of the dumbest decisions I've ever made. I should have put the price point higher, but the good news is it's moving because at 99 cents, there's nothing you can find cheaper than that. And a candy bar is gone in like 5 seconds. This True. Takes a little bit longer to fully and completely digest. $14.99 for the print edition. It has been doing extremely well. It's a tale of the mob gambling and a professional football league that is definitely not the National Football League. That is a caveat that my lawyer, i.e. me, has suggested I provide whenever talking about it. So I can't stop you from envisioning NFL teams when we talk about Las Vegas, Baltimore, Minnesota, etc. But it's not the NFL.
Understood. Glad we got that one taken care of. So the Browns, out of nowhere, story goes, get a phone call from the Cincinnati Bengals, of all people, asking if they would be interested in trading a 40-year-old quarterback to a division rival. What did you think when that all went down?
I wasn't surprised. The Bengals had gone beyond desperation to panic mode. They needed someone other than Jake Browning. They had a backup that they thought could function as a starter, and he didn't. 3 interceptions last week, losses galore. He was 4-3 as the starter in 2023 when Joe Burrow had a wrist injury, but it just wasn't working. Blown out by the Vikings, embarrassed by the Broncos, blown out by the Lions in a game that looked not as bad as it was because of some garbage time touchdowns by Cincinnati. They had to do something. I'm surprised they didn't call the Giants for Russell Wilson or Jameis Winston. And from the Browns' perspective, hey, this is found money. This is a guy that was on the roster the rest of his salary this year as a practical matter guaranteed. They didn't intend to play him again. They're not going to pivot from Dylan Gabriel back to Joe Flacco. The only way Flacco would have played is if the other two guys, Gabriel and Shedeur Sanders, had played and gotten injured. So this is a bonus. This is an upgrade of a draft pick from round 6 to round 5 in this trade with the Bengals. And the way the Bengals are going, it could be a pretty high 5th-round pick. So I understand why they did it. And they're not going to get caught up in this idea of you don't trade within the division. It's all analytics-driven. Analytics don't take division rivalries into account. They got something when they otherwise would have gotten nothing.
What's going on here? can you help me? I'm sitting here. We sit here every day, and I'm wondering what it looks like outside of Cuyahoga County, or even though our county commissioner doesn't realize that where they're building. Never mind. That's another story for another day. What when you look at what the Browns are doing right now, what do you see?
Well, a wise man known as Juju Smith-Schuster once said, "The Browns is the Browns," and you know, the idea that Kevin Stefanski didn't even know the trade was coming on the surface, you'd say that's surprising. But, you know, this is a team where I believe, based upon the various pieces of circumstantial evidence over the course of the last 13 years, I believe the owner is very involved in pushing the needle toward the things he wants. And one of the benefits of being a multi-billionaire is you never have to give a direct order. When your preferences are made known to the people who work for you and who presumably hope to continue to work for you, they act accordingly. So, this is a team that has prioritized certain things from time to time, like stockpiling salary cap space and getting as many draft picks for the future as they can. They see what's happening this year. They understand that the road to contention is going to be very difficult. They're now trying to see what they have in Dylan Gabriel. They may eventually see what they have in Shedeur Sanders as they evaluate what they're going to do with their first-round pick next year, which could be high enough to get a potential franchise quarterback all over again. So I understand what they're doing. You know, even though they beat the Packers, that's more of an aberration than a trend, and they're making business decisions for the future.
Like turning around and trading one pretty decent corner for another pretty decent corner and flopping some picks and adjusting finances? That's all we can think of with the trade with Jacksonville.
Well, the one thing we don't know about the Tyson Campbell for Greg Newsome, the second trade, is whether and to what extent there had been negotiations on a potential extension for Newsome. He's making $13 million this year as his fifth-year option. The franchise tag this year for corners is just over $20 million. It'll probably be $22, $23 million next year because the cap always goes up. And we don't know what Newsome may have been looking for by way of a long-term contract. What you get now is 3 years of Tyson Campbell after this season. You get him this year for $1.08 million. That's the balance of his salary for 2025. The next 3 years average out to $15.2 million. That's well below the $19.175 million new money average on the contract he signed last year in Jacksonville. So they're getting a guy that they know is going to be there. And they've already had the contract pre-negotiated with millions in hand that were transferred by the Jaguars. The Jaguars are going to take a $22 million dead money charge next year for this contract. That's $22 million that's already been paid to Campbell that the Browns don't have to pay. So I think that it's as simple as they didn't think they were going to be able to keep Newsome on a long-term deal. And when you play out the franchise tag, hey, let's just pay a guy $15.2 million for 3 years. Now, the only caveat is Tyson Campbell may decide, I want more money at some point sooner than later, and then they'll have an issue there. But on paper, they have a guy under contract through 2027 at an average of $15.2 million, and it gave them a longer-term answer at the position than they had with Newsome. And again, they're not going to advertise this, or maybe they'll leak it to help justify it, but if Newsome's people were looking – for market level compensation, to be able to get Campbell at $15 million a year is a pretty good deal.
What do you think is going on with the Browns quarterback situation? Where do you think they want to go? Like, the Flacco thing caught me a little off guard that Kevin was like, oh, it just kind of happened. And, you know, we sit here and Mike, we're arguing about our number three quarterback here. Like that dominates the airwaves here in Cleveland for a guy who's the emergency quarterback on Sunday. Like, what do you think the big plan was? And what do you think the plan is? Because Jeff and I will sit here and say, well, they're going to take those two first-round picks and draft somebody next year.
Well, it's all analytics. I mean, that's what drives these decisions. And they don't think about team building. They don't think about the human dynamics. There's no formula for that. When you use a third-round pick on Dylan Gabriel and you send the message that this guy is potentially going to be the future, and then 2 rounds later you draft Shedeur Sanders because the gap between him and the next available player was so big you could no longer ignore it, then you create a situation where you're going to have these issues. And I doubt that there was any effort by the team, whether it was the GM or the chief strategy officer, the head coach, whoever was involved in the decision. And at the end of the day, These are things that get nudged by ownership. You have to be very careful as an owner to not weigh in with what you would like to have happen, because it is, as I said, very easy for the people who work for you to read your cues and do the thing that they think you want them to do. And so you have this mess now where Shadur is going to create a headline no matter what he says, or even if he says nothing at all. And this is where the Browns are, and they have to figure this one out. I saw the report over the weekend that the expectation is Shadur will play at some point this year. That if that's the expectation, then that really is a recognition that they're not going to contend. Because if Dylan Gabriel would play well and the team would start winning games, why in the hell would you bench him for Shadur Sanders? So if that's true, that they already plan to play him at some point this year, then they really are in 2026 mode, and everything that happens now is just a precursor to next year. It reminds me of the claims that Hugh Jackson made after he was fired and after he got every dollar of his buyout. You know, he filed a grievance with the league suggesting that he was the fall guy. He was the scapegoat for this plan that basically was sophisticated tanking. You know, Nobody tried to lose, but hey, people get bonuses. People get incentive payments for the amount of salary cap space we carry from one year to the next. People get bonuses based upon the number of draft picks that we can stockpile for next year. And embedded within all that is sacrificing the present in the name of building the future. And the Browns are the kings of that right now. Forget about the present. Let's build for the future. And then when the future becomes the present, forget about the present. Let's build for the future. And that's been the lather, rinse, repeat cycle for this team for a decade now.
It's interesting you talked about the chief strategy officer there, because somebody sent me this over the weekend and I was like, yeah, I guess he's right. That when they brought in Paul DePodesta since then, and you talk about the analytics, they're 54-80-1. What makes you think the analytics is working correctly when you're 54-80-1? And how many chief strategy officers, I don't even know how many there are in the NFL, how many of them would survive 54-80-1?
Well, not many, and I don't know how many there are. And this was this revolutionary approach that we're going to take a guy who used analytics successfully in baseball and translate that to an entirely different sport where intangibles matter, where the movements of 11 players at the same time, good, bad, otherwise, influence the result, not the individual attributes of the players. You know, in baseball, it's very simple. It's pitcher versus batter and a bunch of bystanders, and you know, they're good enough that they're supposed to do their job when the ball comes their way. So it is a fundamentally different thing. And I think that it's as simple as, you know, look at the Cowboys. Jerry Jones meddles, but he's the general manager. The buck stops with him. He takes the heat when the team is unsuccessful. And obviously, he's never going to fire the GM because the GM is him. In Cleveland, I almost feel like these layers are buffer for the owner getting what the owner wants. And if you're the chief strategy officer and the strategy that you're ultimately implementing is doing the thing that you think the owner wants you to do and coming up with mathematical justification for it, then you're not going to get fired. And that's really the dynamic here. It provides cover for the owner to meddle in the same way that Jerry Jones does without the title of general manager to go along with it. And yeah, the longer that this lasts without accountability, it, I think, creates the logical conclusion that these folks all still have jobs in the front office because they're smart enough to do what the owner wanted them to do. And if it was time to fire these people, you know, the easy response is, hey, we just did what we thought you wanted. And it probably would be hard for Jimmy Haslam to dispute that.
Mike, the trade with Jacksonville, it's interesting, and I think we're all on the same page. There's some money here and kind of looking long-term. With that in mind, trade deadline less than a month away, is a long-term move by the Browns to trade off pieces and accumulate draft choices, or might it be a different approach where they try and poach some young talent off of teams that might be trying to move on from it for late-round picks or something like that?
Well, look, it all depends upon contract status, where the team thinks the player might fit into the future. But I just believe that this team is committed to this idea of having salary cap space and having draft picks, especially when there's still many millions, right? There are nine figures tied up in dead money still to be attributed to Deshaun Watson. I've said before, one of the reasons he's on the team right now, if you cut him now, the dead money charge next year is $135 million. They have structured the contract to kick the can under the salary cap, and there is still going to be a lot of money, a lot of funny money that is attributed to his name in the future. So they have an extra incentive to get as much salary cap space as they can because so much of it is still going to be tied up in really what was the single worst transaction in NFL history, especially when you sprinkle on top of the contract and the draft picks that were lost, which are very affordable players who become the heart and soul of your team if you still have those picks. The rise of Baker Mayfield has to be taken into account too, and that just makes a horrible decision by the Browns seem even worse.
Do you think Deshaun is on this team when that contract expires?
Well, the only...
In other words, is he here next year for the season?
I think so. I think so because they've done these extensions and they've kicked the salary cap money into future years. And I'd have to do some research, which is a fancy way of saying I don't know what the consequences would be if they would cut him with a post-June 1 designation after the season. I don't know what that would do. It would at a minimum push a bulk of the cap charges into the 2027 league year, but I think they have it set up so they have the voidable years that carry the cap charges out in the future years, and you need to keep him around long enough, possibly until the full completion of the contract, to get the benefit of this structuring they've done to push the cap charges out in the future years. And in hindsight, they probably wish they'd just taken the cap charges now, because what is the cap space that they've saved done for them? Nothing.
Hmm. All right, ease Browns fans' mind, or let them know, especially because the defense isn't playing so well. Do you think, you kind of alluded to it a little bit before, but as they get closer to the trade deadline, do you think they'll be selling off pieces?
Well, it all depends upon what pieces they think aren't going to be part of the team next year. Once you're aware that you're not going to have a guy on the team next year, then you get into the analysis of, wait a minute, are we going to cut him? Because if you're going to cut him, you've got no chance of getting compensation via the compensatory draft pick system. Are we going to let him walk away as a free agent? What are we going to do? But once you know the guy's not going to be there, and if you're not playing the compensatory draft pick game, if they intend to go out and sign a bunch of free agents and maybe they wouldn't get compensatory draft picks anyway, then you start looking for compensation now. So it's all to be determined, and the trade deadline is the Tuesday after week 9. Remember, it was the Browns who proposed that it be moved from the Tuesday after week 8 until the Tuesday after week 9. That gives the bad teams more time to conclude that they're bad and that they should go ahead and sell off pieces. So I think they're in play right now, you know, unless they start winning some games. Whenever we start getting closer and closer to the trade deadline, it's an annual item that we end up dusting off and repackaging and pointing out again. It comes down to what happens those last couple of weeks for a lot of these teams. If you win the last couple of games before the trade deadline, you feel differently about selling. If you lose them, you feel differently about selling off assets. And conversely, you know, teams can become buyers if they get hot between now and week 9. So I think a lot of it's to be determined, but we're already seeing the decisions being made to move on from players who they believe won't be with the team next year.
He's Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk, author of Big Shield. Go get it. You can go to Pro Football Talk and get it right there. And Mike, congratulations on the success of the book.
Thank you, guys. Great talking to you.
Hey, thanks.
Mike Florio joining us on the Fan Hotline.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
friends, it's Ken Carmen
and Anthony Lima.
Did you know that the Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima is both a radio show and a podcast?
You can find us anytime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods.
Catch the full episode, listen by the hour, or jump straight to the highlights.
Just open up your favorite podcast app, search our names, and hit the follow button to get every minute of the show.
Your way and on your time.
So to talk about the Newsom and Flacco trades, obviously we can get into Myles Garrett in the season he's having of Sumer Sports on the fan hotline. Lindsay Rhodes joins us right now. Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Hi. Always got to go back to Myles Garrett, huh?
Well, yes. People haven't forgotten, but it turns out it aged very well for you.
Yes.
Okie doke.
You are the the seer among seers. You're the prognosticator on this show because you were seeing it when no one else would, Lindsay.
That's hilarious. Well, I didn't see this trade coming. I think this is a fascinating trade. No, like you don't. I'm talking about the Campbell trade now. I feel like these are the types of trades that you don't really see that frequently in football. We're so used to seeing like a good guy at this position go for a different guy at a different position. It's not that often that you see like a straight corner for corner or, you know, like what's happening here? What's the evaluation that's different? But so I think it's a really fascinating one to dive into.
Well, did you think the Browns got the better end of this, or are you looking at this and saying, how did they get better here?
No, I think when you really look at it, there's definitely an argument to make that both sides maybe won for their different purposes. I think that from a Browns standpoint, I think it's clear that they're thinking about the future. I mean, you don't even need to look at this trade to know that that's the case. I think, you know, Greg Newsom's up for a new deal. He's going to be a free agent. There's uncertainty that goes along with that. Would they be able to bring him back? Did they want to? So this trade takes that uncertainty out of the mix and adds a cornerback that's already under contract. I mean, so it's one less thing that they have to allocate resources towards in the offseason. My guess is that there's also a bit of an evaluation gap on these two cornerbacks to a degree also. My guess is that Cleveland probably thinks there isn't as much difference between the two as maybe the Jags do. And I also think that the Browns are going to use him differently than the Jaguars did. The Jags are in zone coverage at the sixth highest rate, and the Browns are the 25th highest rate. So I think some of the ways in which you might see people dinging Campbell for his play this year, those sometimes are showing up in zone coverage, and I don't think that will be as much of an issue in Cleveland. So I think that for a lot of different reasons, it's easy to look at this and say, okay, like, you know, if we take the Jaguars and what they got out of it, put that completely aside, I think you could make an argument this was a very smart move on the Browns' part.
Lindsay Rhodes on the fan hotline there of Sumer Sports. So some fans are wondering, you mentioned, you know, thinking about the future. We're 5 weeks into the season. Does that equate to the Browns could be on the verge of tanking?
I don't know if I mean, how do I say this nicely? How do you figure out if they are? Like, to a degree, like, you would have to take some defensive pieces off the board, right, in order to make it egregious and obvious that that's what you're doing. I think, to a degree, you are playing a lot of young pieces, and with the idea that you're trying to get better as an offense in particular. But I think you could probably lose a lot of games even while trying to develop properly, if that makes sense. So I think, you know, you've got the two first-round picks. You've got the most draft capital in the entire league going into next year. I think that there's no doubt, even coming into the season, in a perfect world where Joe Flacco played well and he did not play well, but even in a perfect world, this is not a year that the Browns are going to go to the Super Bowl. You know, your best hope at the start of the season is that the Browns will be competitive. And so you started the year thinking about next year. And so I don't necessarily know that it's like that you could fully call it a tank. I think that it is, you're certainly rebuilding on offense. There's things that you want to glean from some of the younger players. Obviously, Gabriel's play will be evaluated the rest of the way, and you'll gain a lot of information about what you have in him, and be able to make decisions about what you want to do moving forward. It feels like the fact that they were able to trade Flacco and actually get a pick back is like chef's kiss. I mean, congratulations to Cleveland for being able to pull that off. I think what they're doing here is just collecting a bunch of lower round picks that they can probably package to move up in the draft to acquire depth. It feels like, you know, the Rams are a great example in the last few years of a team that just flipped a defense like so quickly. And my guess is, looking at the Browns, that they're probably trying to take a similar approach with the offense. And it sounds like they have the draft capital to do that. And so, you know, it's a good offensive tackle draft. There are some good wide receivers there. And then with those low round picks, you could just kind of just gather up a bunch of different people that you can put in camp and say, go compete. And, you know, darts at a dartboard increases the chance that some of them are going to hit. And so I think that you'll probably be looking at a better Browns team next year than this year. And that's always the goal.
Two trades this week. What does your brain tell you is going to happen with trades moving forward?
Well, I mean, we're still a ways out from the trade deadline, which is the other fascinating part of this. Like, it's, I mean, this is an aside, but it just feels like this whole time of year has gotten so much more fun in the last few years. And I think it's driven by a lot of the younger general managers who are sometimes a little bit more into analytics and less like beholden to think that those draft picks are gold and they never want to part with them. They're like, they're playing chess out there and it's super fun. And so I think if stuff comes up where there's an opportunity to, move a few more pieces or pick up a couple of more draft picks without really dramatically downgrading the play on the field this year in a way that would impact them in the future, right? Like I think that this cornerback trade is a perfect example of a way that you can kind of move some pieces around on the board without it actually hurting you on the field. I don't think that this is necessarily, like I said earlier, a downgrade at corner. I think it's just a way to maybe fill a hole that you would leave behind by taking Newsom out of the defense, but also not in a way like this guy Campbell has a deal for the next few years. So you're signing on for him to be your cornerback. That's a big position, right? And so I think that if there are moves that come up in the next few weeks that are similar to this one, where you can move things around in a way that doesn't hurt your chances down the road, then I wouldn't be surprised if they don't do that.
Lindsay, 6 years in, who do you think has done a better job? Kevin Stefanski at his job or Andrew Berry at his?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a really good question. I think both of them have played with one hand behind their back for a good majority of this time, to be honest with you. And that might not be the answer that people want to hear in Cleveland, but I feel like the whole Deshaun Watson thing just makes the evaluation of both of those people so hard. And maybe I would argue it has made it harder for Barry, because of the capital that was sent away, the amount of financial resources that were invested in Watson, and when that doesn't go well. And I think what I'm essentially saying here is that I believe that there's evidence that points to maybe it wasn't 100% their call that they made this move with Watson. I think we have good reason to believe that, and that's why they've been given a few years post-Watson to kind of figure this out, despite the fact that they haven't had success on the field. I think there's a concession a little bit that's like, this isn't your fault. I'm going to give you time to figure your way out of this mess. So I think it makes that evaluation pretty hard. I might lead towards Barry a little bit.
Lindsay, are the Steelers good?
That feels like such a loaded question. My short answer is going to be no. I think that they are probably, I view them as a team that is probably going to be exactly what they have been for the last few years, which Steelers fans hate, which is a team that hovers right around 500, ends up just above 500, isn't really a team that can make a push in the playoffs. I don't see any reason to believe that they are not that. I think the thing that data tells you about aging quarterbacks is that the average depth of target comes down. He has, Aaron Rodgers, the lowest average depth of target in the entire NFL right now. His average depth of target is 5.
So, oh, wow, lower than Joe's was when he was here for the 4 weeks.
It's wild. So so when that starts to happen, zooming out in terms of older quarterbacks, one of the trends that we see is that one of two things happen, and it's not always both. It's either the average depth of target comes down because the arm just can't do what it once did, but you want to keep the accuracy up, and so you lower the A dot, and then every once in a while they can throw it downfield and make a big play, but you're not asking them to do that frequently. Or the average depth of target stays up where it's always been, and they're still slinging it. This was Peyton Manning at the end. He was still slinging it, but his accuracy was all over the place, and his completion percentage over expected tanked that last year that he was on the field. So there's one of two things usually comes down. And in the case of Aaron Rodgers, it's been the average depth of target. I just don't see a way that you're going to get through the rest of the season knowing that they have to somewhat keep it close to the line and not find defenses that can go, I know exactly what to do against this. And so I tend to think that, no, they're not particularly good. Like I said, I think we're probably looking at a 500 or slightly above 500 team there.
Lindsay, is the AFC really this wide open, or by the end of the season, is it going to be the same four, five, six players that it always is?
That's a tricky one. I think one of the biggest stories this year so far has been the AFC South, right? Like, I mean, the fact that you've got Indy and you've got Jacksonville and then honestly, to a degree, Houston, which I think we all assume is going to be in the mix. Indy has, I think, scoring differential, and there's no doubt that early in the season, smaller sample size that will widen out. Their strength of schedule has not been the hardest in the league, but for the last few weeks, they've played some pretty good teams, and they've continued to stay competitive in a way where I think you have to sort of take them seriously, or more seriously than maybe we did through 3 weeks. But they're number one in the league in scoring differential. They have outscored their opponents by 74 points. Number two in the AFC in that category is Houston, sitting in the 9 seed right now at 2-3 with a plus 47 scoring differential. And then you've got Jacksonville at plus 27 in the 5 seed right now. Like, that's the biggest surprise of the year. We thought that division was trash coming into the year. And so the fact that Indianapolis has found a way, in particular, I think, to be as competitive as they have, and they've done what they've done with Daniel Jones. The other story of the year, I think, has been the veteran quarterbacks and the bucket that he belongs to in that category, just really exceeding expectations. Daniel Jones, Baker Mayfield, and Sam Darnold are 1, 2, and 4 in total EPA on the season. And I think all of them are kind of putting together a really interesting story of the retread quarterback, you know, being something that we might need to look into a little bit more deeply. But so I do think that the Chiefs, I am not comfortable writing them off regardless. They're going to get Rashee Rice back, and I think that their schedule in the early going has been really tough. The Ravens' schedule in the early going has been wild. My concern with them is that they're sitting at 1-4, and they've got a game against the Rams coming up this year. I mean, this week. And I just think there's a strong possibility, especially if Lamar's not on the field, which it looks like he's not going to be, that they're 1-5. I just don't know if that's too deep of a hole, even though the schedule eases up for them after this week. I don't know if that's too deep a hole to dig yourselves out of. So I think the schedule makers and then obviously the injuries that they've suffered on top of that did them absolutely no favors.
Lindsay, great stuff as always. See, we didn't mention Myles Garrett one more time, except right then when I mentioned it.
I'm going to let us end on that. He's good.
All right, so we're going to put the headline here.
He's good.
Lindsay Rhodes says, bleep that contract, still trade Myles. Is that what I hear?
You're so in-depth with your analysis and everything, we could just do... Lindsay thinks Myles is good at football.
Yeah. If we were friends, that's what we would do.
Boil it down to the simplest possible analysis you could have.
Why do you have that stupid chick on? No duh.
Lindsay, great stuff. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
Lindsay Rhodes, Sumer Sports on the Fan Hotline.
Who's the guy you argued with?
Gorbachev.
No, it's not No.
Yes, Gorbachev, Gorbadel, epic debates.
I keep wanting to say George Will, and it's not George Will.
Mary George
Kate,
Went.
George, no, George Went passed away. Mary Kate Cabot, hello.
Hello, guys. How you doing?
We're doing okay. It's good to see you. William F. Buckley. That's who it was. Thank you. Oh, okay. All right, we can do that now. Mary Kay Cabot, she joins us on the fan hotline. Mary Kay, is there a power struggle in Berea right now?
You know what? I really don't think so. They collaborate on those decisions. I saw that people were trying to make it seem that Kevin had absolutely no idea that Joe Flacco was getting traded. I think when he talked about the surprise of Joe Flacco, the surprise was the fact that the Bengals picked up the phone and called them out of the blue. I really don't think it was a situation where Andrew Berry is in the building just blindsiding Kevin with decisions. Now, sometimes it does work out like that because these things happen very quickly. But I don't think this is a situation where Kevin is in the dark and Andrew is over there just making moves on his own.
Okay. Mary Kay, you have reported on a lot of locker rooms that might have been fine at the start of the year, but by the end of the year turn into a completely different animal. Does that have the potential here with one veteran like Newsom getting jettisoned, you know, Flacco already gone, and, you know, who knows who could be next? Do you think there's any concern at all about this season and what could happen the rest of the way?
Well, what you have to do in a situation like this is that you really do have to talk to your leadership group. You have to talk to your veterans. You have to make sure that they understand what's going on. I did ask Denzel Ward yesterday if he believed that the Browns are still 100% committed to winning this season instead of just playing rookie ball now. And he said he 100% believes that. I don't know how this trade yet has impacted him because we haven't seen him since then. But I would have to think that once you start trading some of your longtime veterans, it can rattle some of your other players. So you have to communicate very effectively with them and make sure they understand what the game plan is and that they're still in a place where winning is paramount.
Do you believe Bailey Zappe will be the backup quarterback on Sunday?
It's a great question. I wrote a whole column about this yesterday, and I made a very strong case that I think he should be. And I just wrote that because that's how I feel, and I have no idea if Kevin's going to do that. In fact, they might absolutely 100% make Shedeur Sanders the backup for this football game. But I don't think they should for so many reasons that I outlined in this column. The first of which, and the most important reason I'm citing here, is the fact that Shedeur Sanders, I think, would be best served by heading into a football game with a game plan designed for his skill set. If he has to go in against the Pittsburgh Steelers, all they've practiced all week is a Dylan Gabriel scheme. He's more mobile. He's different. There are just different traits these two guys have. You're not going to be calling, you know, the RPOs and the, you know, the bootlegs and the rollouts and the keepers and the design runs and different things that you will call for Dylan. Now, I'm making him sound like he's Lamar Jackson. He's not that. But he is definitely mobile enough, and that was his game in college, to zip around and make off-schedule plays at times and avoid sacks and do all those things. That is not Shedeur's game. They would have to devise a game plan that is going to maximize Shedeur's skill set. And one of his superpower, his number one superpower, is his elite accuracy. I see it even in the short amount of time that we are now allowed to watch practice. He is still showing off this uncanny elite accuracy. It's really something to behold. I see him do things that it's elite level accuracy is what I'm seeing out there. So he's got some amazing things that he can do as well. It's just not the Dylan things. And I think when he goes into a football game, he should have the supporting cast, the plays, and everything else designed to help him. So it's really not about him not being ready. It's about him not being game planned for this week. And why can Bailey do that, even though he's also a drop back passer? Because Bailey's been around for 4 years. He would more easily be able to adapt to some of the things that Dylan's doing. He would play faster. He can pivot. He can be thrown into a situation. He has been thrown into situations before. He's also started 9 games, won 4 of them, including one in Pittsburgh when he was with the New England Patriots. So there are a lot of reasons that I'm citing that I think this should happen, but I believe this is how it should go.
Mary Kay, join us on the hotline. So it seemed as if the phrasing when the Joe Flacco news came down from Kevin Stefanski was, you know, surprised. Obviously, he actually used that term. I know people use that to believe, oh, is he even talking to his GM? Well, he's got, you know, a team to coach, and he can't be making calls or fielding calls. But with that said, what kind of say after 6 years with the Browns does Kevin Stefanski have over decision making? Does he have any say? Typically, coaches at around 6 years, they gain power in an organization. Does he have that power? Or does he even want that power?
They collaborate on everything. Those two guys are in lockstep. They're in each other's ear and offices all the time. And here's the thing with the Joe Flacco trade. Was Andrew going to go to Kevin and say, hey, I won't do this if you don't want me to? I mean, what would be the benefit in keeping Joe Flacco around for the rest of this season when he is not going to play football for the Cleveland Browns anymore?
Is that because, Mary Kay, they're 1-4? Sorry to cut you off, but I just want to clarify. Is it because they're 1-4? If they were 3-1, would you ask that question? Or if they were 2-3?
If they were 3-1, he would never have been benched in the first place. Okay, so and maybe even if they were 2-3, he would not have been benched in the first place. But because he was benched, he provides almost no value for the Cleveland Browns for the rest of this season. They don't need him around as a babysitter or a mentor. They don't need that. That's not good use of their time or his time. So if you can get something, even though they didn't get very much, if you could get something and he has an opportunity to go and play, then why not do that? I can't see any reason why Kevin Stefanski, if given the opportunity, would have said, no, I don't want to do that. Let's keep Joe here. We really need him. It wasn't going to be about Joe for the rest of the season. He wasn't going to play unless there was some emergency type of situation. Now, he may have remained the backup for another few weeks or so, but at some point it's going to get to the point where Shador is going to be the backup and they probably are going to want to see what he can do on the football field. I don't know if that's going to be this week. I don't know if that's going to be next week. I have no idea when that will happen, but they probably will try to get some playing time for Shador this year.
Well, I love this conversation, Mary Kay, because we're not privy to that building. We always hear thought partners. You maintain, and you've done more reporting than anybody on this, that they are lockstep. But there does come a time where there's going to be more discussion on sacrificing, you know, important players for the season for the betterment of the team long term. And if they're on lockstep, then Stefanski would probably be okay if they traded David Njoku, right? If that helped them long term rather than short term.
Well, they're balancing short term versus long term right now. They've got short term goals, long term goals, and those goals do change if it becomes apparent that you're out of the playoff hunt. But right now, the AFC North is so weird that you can't say that you're completely out of it yet. Anything can still happen. I know it's a long shot for the Browns to get back in it. I know it doesn't seem even remotely possible, but you never really know. You have to let this thing play out. So I don't think they're jettisoning players just for the sake of it. I think when you look at the Greg Newsom trade, they feel like they got a player of comparable value in terms of on-the-field skill set, and they are saving money over the next 3 years on what they would have had to pay Greg Newsom in an extension because he's going to get paid. He's having a really nice season. I think he's off to the best start of his career, actually. And he's going to get paid. He's probably going to get $20 million a year or more. And the Browns probably, they would have paid that. I think that they would have definitely extended Greg, and he would have been in line for that kind of money. But Campbell will average significantly less than that over the next three seasons. He's under contract through 2028.
Mary Kay Cabot joining us here on the show. So what other names could be on the move here?
Well, I do think that you might have to look at players that are in the final year of their contract, and if someone views them as a piece of their puzzle to get where they want to go for the rest of this year, those are the kinds of players that, you know, that might be in line for something like that, or that you might take phone calls on. And again, I know that David is in the last year of his contract, so I don't know. I'm sure teams might call about him, not 100% sure. I know that at the beginning of the year, the Browns wanted to extend him, and he wanted to stay here and get extended, but so did Greg. So you never really know. I haven't heard anything yet about whether or not David would be somebody that they would be willing to part with, but they also haven't extended him yet. So, you know, it's guys in that category that teams will call about. It's not that the Browns are shopping them, but guys in that category that that a team thinks could help them this season, they'll call about those guys.
Mary Kay Cabot joining us here on the Fan Hotline. Go ahead, Tom.
All right, so as they're getting ready for a rivalry game in Pittsburgh this week, and they've got Dylan Gabriel there, do you think the offense opens up? Do you think they go as conservative as they did last week, where the throws beyond 10, 15 yards, few and far between?
Well, you have to stretch the defense somehow a little bit. You've got to get that box loosened up. You cannot have Quinshon Judkins trying to run through a stacked box every single time, because that is what happened in the fourth quarter of that game in London, and he wasn't able to make many yards. And so they have to find a way to get their passing game going. I think they need to get their tight ends involved more. They tried to get Harold Fannin involved in that game. He only ended up having 13 yards. That's not acceptable. Their three receivers combined for a total of 5 receptions. That's not going to cut it. So they now have to go back to the drawing board with Dylan. Now that they've seen him play in a game, they've seen him operate, maybe they need to loosen it up for him a little bit, give him some things that are a little bit less conservative, trust him a little bit more, and maybe they'll also have more of Cam Robinson so they can feel a little bit more comfortable about what they have at tackle, and that will let them air it out a little bit more for him. I think they have to. I think they have to find a way to get the ball into the hands of their playmakers. They have to hope that those receivers will fare better with Dylan than they did with Joe. Jerry Judy's got to come around. We talked to him yesterday, and you know, he's just trying to keep doing the right thing and get himself back on track. So they have to get the passing game going if they want to keep the running game viable.
Mary Kay, thank you very much for the time. All the best to you and yours, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Mary Kay Cabot on the Fan Hotline.
There you are.
He's brought to us by Scheiben Jewelers, Cleveland's premier jewelry store.
Kevin Stefanski press conference just wrapping up. We should have a press conference coming up with Dylan Gabriel very shortly, probably right off the top of the hour. Daryl Ryder is with us. Hello, Daryl, our Browns Beat reporter. How are you?
Good, guys. How are you?
Good. Good questions in that press conference, my friend. Nice job. But where are we with this thing right now? Because I, to me, I'm still trying to figure out, did Kevin Stefanski know this trade was going on? Did Kevin have any say in the trade? That was one of the questions I was kind of hoping we might get some insight on. And then who is the number two? Did he lean one way or another? Because it sounded to us like he was leaning towards Bailey Zappe.
Well, where do you want me to start? you asked about 4 questions.
Yeah.
Which one do you want me to hit first?
Well, I mean, we're still trying to digest this, too. Let's start with, did Kevin know what was going on?
He did say that Andrew Berry makes those decisions and he trusts in Andrew Berry. He also said that the trade caught them by surprise, that the Bengals called them and wanted Joe, and it came together very quickly. So I am going to guess no. Kevin did not seem like a guy that was thrilled that his veteran 40-year-old quarterback got traded. That being said, I think Joe Flacco is thrilled that he got traded because he doesn't have to sit and you know, hold the clipboard here. He'll get the play and probably going to play this weekend for the Bengals. So, he did not sound like a coach today. He was thrilled about this move, but also understanding that it's, you know, out of his hands. He can't really worry about it. He's got to focus on, you know, the room that he's left with.
So do you think they said to Kevin, hey, should we do this? You don't think they asked him, do you?
No, I don't. I think that, you know, look, Andrew's the EVP of football operations. He made the decision. He made the trade, and that's the way she goes.
Too bad they had to send a 6th in the trade, too, Daryl. That one's like, okay, well, there you go.
I'm not the least bit upset that the Browns included a 3rd-day pick in this trade at all, as somebody who doesn't like 3rd-day picks. So
I get it. But you basically, yeah, I, you basically handed your opponent, who you're trying to catch, a guy they're going to play at quarterback, and the most you can do is move up 62 spots in the draft.
Well, here's the thing, Jeff. They're not going to see Joe Flacco in Week 18. I think they'll see Joe Burrow. So I don't think this trade matters materially to whether or not the Browns are going to have to play against Joe Flacco.
No, that's not what I meant. I mean, you've given them a starting quarterback, in their estimation, who might be able to hold down the fort.
Have you seen that Bengals offensive line?
Oh, Daryl, I'm with you.
It's about as good as the Browns.
Daryl, so. I don't think Joe can play. I think Joe's done. So, yeah. But I think he'll I think he'll throw it to Jamar Chase and T. Higgins.
Yeah, I don't think that in the grand scheme of things right now, you know, I think the Browns have bigger problems. Other than, you know, what Joe Flacco may or may not be able to do for the Cincinnati Bengals. They've got some other issues here, starting with their own quarterback situation. And, you know, I have an idea of what I think is going to happen this weekend in the next couple of weeks as far as the backup goes. But
I want to hear. What do you think? What are they going to do with the backup?
Before that, how about the starter?
Well, it's going to be – well, Dylan Gabriel's starting. That's not changing. But
for the weeks ahead?
Yeah, I think that Bailey Zappe will be the second quarterback because they can elevate him from the practice squad and make him QB2. Now, the rule states that your emergency quarterback has to already be on the 53-man roster. Well, who's already on the 53-man roster? That would be Shedeur Sanders.
Yeah.
And Kevin does not sound like he's ready to make Shedeur the backup quarterback. So I think Bailey Zappe will be elevated for the next couple of weeks until the rule expires and he has to be added to the 53 to remain the backup. But I think that that's what they're going to do. And that's the easiest thing for them to do.
Or did they create a space for Deshaun Watson?
No. Did you not listen to what Kevin said when asked about Deshaun?
Does it matter? But listen, does what I'm saying... Does what Kevin says matter if you think he didn't? If he had no say in Joe Flacco being dealt, what's the difference?
The difference is Deshaun Watson is the third rail, and Kevin didn't want to touch that with a 10-foot cattle prod.
He may not have a choice, though.
Yeah, I think that the organization is more than prepared to move on from Deshaun. And I don't foresee a situation where Andrew Berry walks into Kevin's office and says, "Hey, oh, by the way, Deshaun Watson has to be QB2.
But what happens medically if they say he's healthy to play?
Well, and that's what I was trying to get at with Kevin, because and that's why I asked the question I did, because I do feel like Deshaun is trying to force the Browns' hands by putting those videos out to say, "Hey, look, I'm doing the cone drills and I'm throwing the football and I'm doing all these things. Like, physically, I'm healthy. I'm in one piece." You know, I can't obviously speak to like the quality of the play, but like structurally he's able to like do the job, if you will. And I feel like that's what he's doing by putting those videos out. And then you heard Kevin say at the AI, "I really don't care what the guys are posting on social media. Maybe I'm the only one," but like, yeah, you are, Kevin, because that does matter. It's at some point, I think the rubber is going to have to meet the road there when it comes to Deshaun. Now, do I believe that they want to play him this year? Absolutely not. But, you know, to your point, they're going to have to come to crossroads.
I can't see if he is healthy and is allowed to be physically cleared to play NFL football. Right. And they're not? What, you don't think the NFLPA is going to jump in this? You don't think his lawyers are going to jump in this?
You Shedeur him, right? You activate him. He's on the 53, but he doesn't play. That's simple, right?
I mean, Shedeur's
on the active 53, not playing. So,
but then you still need another quarterback. So then you're going to dress three quarterbacks and have a quarterback on the practice squad again.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, we'll see.
Everyone that wanted to argue with me about saying they're going to keep three quarterbacks or four quarterbacks on the active roster, I said, it's not happening. It's not happening. It's not happening. And guess what? They traded Pickett. I don't know how they're going to do this.
They traded Pickett. They traded Flacco. Half the guys that got reps in training camp are no longer here.
Yeah.
It really was a waste of time to do what they did.
Because they gave away all those reps, right?
They're obviously not going to admit that. You know, they're not going to say, "Oh, yeah, we totally, messed up by, handling training camp the way we did. They're not going to admit their mistake publicly, but, you know, when you look at it, yeah, it was pretty stupid to invest all that time in two guys that, you know, we're approaching mid-October and neither one of those guys are here, right? I'll be honest with you, they might have been better off starting Dylan Gabriel from week one and just getting him ready is a third-round pick. Now, do I agree that that's what should? No, but just, you know, the helicopter view of things, yeah, they probably would have been better off just starting getting Dylan Gabriel ready for week one and starting him than wasting time with Joe Flacco and wasting time with Kenny Pickett. But, Darryl, you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Was it stupid or was it a plan?
Could have been both, right? I mean, you know, this is all about what's really clear is it's about developing these kids, right? Andrew Berry has a very good rookie draft class. So that really puts a dent in the Andrew Berry can't draft players narrative that's out there. He drafted a very good class here. And it's not just one of those situations where, oh, these five guys are playing. No, these guys are playing well. Mason Graham's playing well. Carson Schlesinger's playing well. Quinshon Judkins is playing well. Harold Fannin Jr. is playing well. Dylan Gabriel did not go out and embarrass himself. I won't say he's playing well, but he at least didn't embarrass himself, right?
Yep, too early.
It's early, but like the early returns on this draft class are extremely positive. So I think Andrew Berry is absolutely going to be safe. I don't know. Maybe Kevin Stefanski realizes he might not be safe. I don't know.
Yeah, I keep walking out of this. If that's the scenario that we're kind of all walking out of that press conference with, it's you wonder, are Andrew and Kevin still on the same page? Are they still thought partners?
Yeah, I certainly can't speak to that. I mean, you know,
Darryl, I don't think you and I have ever really questioned that until we watched Sunday's when we watched Sunday's game and we talked about it afterwards. And I was like, man, this is the first time it feels like Kevin just is disjointed with what's going on. And then today you get this press conference.
Yeah, I mean, this was an all-time Browns head coach press conference, right?
Right.
And this is up there. I mean, he said a lot without saying a lot. And this is the first time where I'm like, well, you know, because I've always been convinced that Andrew was coming, that Andrew wasn't going anywhere. But now, I mean, here's the reality. It hasn't mattered the quarterback. It hasn't mattered the coordinator. His offense can't score 17, can only score 17 points in games. That's a problem. Like, he's got to get that figured out. It is a very boring, in some cases predictable, offense that's not producing at the league averages, right? I mean, you said it on our post-game YouTube. Like, the NFL basically gives you 20 points a game, and these guys can't get to 20 points a game. They've lost 14 of 22 games, they've only won four of the last 22, and in only three of those games have they been able to put more than 17 points on the scoreboard. That's a problem. And again, it hasn't mattered who the quarterback has been, hasn't mattered who the coordinator is. And that's something that Kevin's going to have to get figured out here, is finding ways to get explosive plays, get points on the scoreboard, because that microscope that he's under is just going to keep zooming in on that fact, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you're losing games because you are scoring points, you're getting explosive plays, you can live with that. But again, he had, what, four quarterbacks last year. He's two deep this year, probably definitely going three deep, right? The only question is, do they go four deep again? And, you know, they're not scoring points, and that's what they're going to have to figure out. But I kind of feel like, just, you know, listening to that press conference today, Kevin gets it. Like, he understands, like, man, you know, it hasn't, you know, mattered what quarterback I have, right? I kind of feel like he's feeling that a little bit with just the way he answers some of those questions.
Can they beat Pittsburgh?
Hmm. Oh, wait, there's a game this week?
There's a game.
Well, they haven't won there in 21 years, if my math is correct. So you're going in with a rookie quarterback making his second NFL start. I'm going to say the odds are not heavily in their favor.
All right, Darryl.
But anything's possible. That's why you play the games. You never say never. But I'm just saying the odds are not in their favor.
Mm-hmm. All right, we need you to go get in that Dylan Gabriel press conference. So go back to work, buddy.
Yeah, we're going to speak to him here probably in about 5 to 10 minutes or so.
All right, and we'll carry that too. So we're looking forward to having that. And of course, we got to make sure we watch Brownie Bites immediately following every Browns game. Daryl and I break it down, and it's a lot of fun. It's on YouTube, right, my friend?
On YouTube, and then later on this afternoon, I'll have the daily Brownie Bites, all the highlights from the locker room, and of course, Kevin Stefanski's press conference, where he said a lot without saying anything.
I think the reason I stopped using tanking is it became a catch-all for any rebuild. And that's the thing that I was like, guys, that's not tanking. Like, there is the off-season tanking where everybody gets on the same page and says, we're going to tear this thing down and we're going to be so bad that we're unwatchable. And everybody knows that. And then there's the thing that happens where you get in the season, you're not good, and you're like, well, let's not win too many games and screw us in the long run.
Yeah,
I think those are different versions of the same thing, but that's not that's a tributary of rebuilding, not necessarily the kind of linchpin. But in studio now with us, you know him, you love him, of The Athletic, NBA reporter Joe Vardon joins us. What's up, buddy?
You know, tanking happens in the NBA every now and then, too.
I think there was a team here around the town that might have done that once or twice. So just on that point of tanking, though, have you kind of seen that? That word, which I think is very definitive and specific, has kind of been morphed into more of like a broader term that maybe it doesn't apply to everything.
Absolutely. Yeah. First of all, players never tank. Mm-hmm. They are never involved in that. When they are playing for money in a violent sport like the NFL or even in the NBA, when they are on the floor, they're trying to win. They do not care about the future. That's one. The coaching staffs, they may care. They may participate in tanking. And the way that you would see it, at least in our sport with the NBA, is when you get into the fourth quarter and, you know, the coach is playing a lineup that's competitive and is keeping it close against a team like Cleveland that's very good. And then they pull those guys with 5 or 6 minutes left. That is a coach participating in tanking. The front office is ultimately the part of the organization that's going to decide this group isn't working, or we need to get worse so we can get better. And that's when, you know, trades are made where it looks like they're trading away players they were counting on this year.
All right, Joe, I don't have too many pressing Cavs questions for you.
Okay.
There's just a couple. Obviously, everyone knows how good they are, how expected this season is supposed to go. We'll get to the postseason side of it in a second. I do want to ask you about Malik Beasley, though. Mm-hmm. It's the hot name over the previous 24 hours. Shams had the report out there that there was interest. If he does, in fact, get cleared, Malik Beasley to the Cavs. Make it make sense.
Well, I mean, from a fit standpoint, you have to think about Max Strus being out for months. You know, if he plays at all, it won't be until after the All-Star break. And so behind him, you know, there's DeAndre Hunter, who they're going to count on a ton. But they're pretty young. I mean, they're going to look at Jalen Tyson at getting some minutes. And so, you know, Beasley is a knockdown three-point shooter. He's been around forever. I think he would be a really good veteran presence in a vacuum. This idea about the NBA investigation into the gambling stuff, like, that's no small thing. And that is the reason that he's not on a team. So, yes, of course, the Cavs are interested. There are going to be other teams that are interested too and might even be able to pay a little bit more money than what the Cavs can offer. But just because Malik's agent is out there saying, he's been cleared, you know, by this group or by that group, like, the investigation is still ongoing and he's not out of the woods yet.
Joe, I'm curious because at the end of the postseason, when the Cavs got bounced out by Indiana, there was that same message for a second year of, we got to get tougher. We got to get, and in fairness, they did specify we got to get stronger in the gym, that kind of stuff. And then at Media Day this year, they were like, we don't need to get tougher. So I'm just curious, one, did you notice the change in messaging there? And is toughness still a debate for this Cavs team heading into year two of Kenny Atkinson?
Well, it has to be because of the way these postseasons keep ending. They either end with way too many players out with serious injury or with nagging injury. You know, people forget that Caris LeVert 2 years ago missed game five against Boston with a knee bruise. I mean, that was stunning. You know, that's just not something you see in New York or with Indianapolis or any of the teams that we consider to be tough. You know, obviously the series against the Pacers turned when in game two you didn't have Garland, Hunter, or Mobley in uniform, and they were all questionable coming into that game. So that suggests there was a chance they could play. Now, if we want to get into the semantics over, you know, were these guys actually questionable or was that some gamesmanship, fine. But the fact is, you know, the word toughness factors into that. I think after an off season, you know, a chance to let your pride heal, I could see the Cavs coming in and saying that that's not the issue. I'm not sure it's the issue either. You know, this is something that I've been saying. I've said it on your show a number of times. You know, my main concern with this team is just they have two smaller guards that they rely on in a playoff series, both very talented, great players. But NBA history tells you that it is really hard to win with two guards starting who are 6'3 or under. And that's what we have with Donovan and Darius. That's my main thing. Like, I feel like Jared Allen could be fine in the right playoff series. I think Evan Mobley is going to continue to get better. His arms are even bigger than they were a year ago. You know, so like I like this team. I like to downplay the toughness angle. But until they show that they can win with the two smaller guards playing together, I think that's the biggest question.
Yeah, how many years do we do this, though? You know, and I get it. Kobe constructed this team. He's going to fight for it more than anybody else. But how many years do we do this where you have two smalls and then two, obviously, with between Allen and Mobley, just two bigs? Like, it's between your front court and your back court, it doesn't make sense for a lot of people.
Well, Jonathan, that is the fundamental question going on in the NBA right now. Not just in Cleveland, but now it's being talked about in Orlando. It's being talked about in any city where the team has taken on a bunch of salaries to go and try and win. Because of the current salary rules in the NBA, it's genuinely believed right now that when you take on multiple max contracts, your window to compete with that particular team is a couple of years. The thinking goes that if after a couple of years you're spending all this money and you don't get there, that the restrictions on how you can change your roster based on how much you're paying your guys are too severe to keep that group together. So we're saying that if Cleveland doesn't win now, they're going to break this team up because of how expensive it is. But Dan Gilbert's a really rich guy. And if he wants to pay for this roster continually, he can. There's no rule that says that he can't. It's just that if you're gonna keep this group together, it becomes even more difficult to make a trade around the edges to improve the group that you already have. So, long way of saying, like, it might be this year where they've got to really get far in the playoffs or there's going to be a big move made.
Joe Vardon of The Athletic, live here in studio with us. So I know your most recent, or one of your most recent pieces on The Athletic was about this, but walk us through what Project B is.
Project B, and this is going to sound corny, Project B has kept me up at night because of what it actually represents. You know, I'm a huge golf fan. I think you guys know that. Certainly all the golf courses in Northeast Ohio know that, how I've spent my last couple months. So I'm really into the PGA Tour, really know a lot about, you know, the split with LIV Golf, which is where some of the stars left to start a new league, a new tour that was paid for by the public investment fund in Saudi Arabia. That same movement is either underway or is certainly like rustling, you know, in the shadows towards being underway. And that is what Project B is or was. It's a group of investors. Two of them are from Silicon Valley. They count the Saudis as a partner. And they went ahead and they tabbed Maverick Carter, who we all know as a fellow Northeast Ohioan and is one of the closest people on earth to LeBron James, as an advisor. And for the last year plus, they have been raising billions of dollars, although like raising is a little bit of a funny word when your partner is the Saudis. You don't need to raise money, but they've been going around, they've been securing investors, and they've been talking to players and talking to player agents about this idea of a second option to the NBA. That's LIV basketball. And that, you know, it's been a fear, I think, for any other pro league since the moment that LIV Golf was started. But like, that was something that appeared to be heading towards, fruition in the NBA as recently as a couple days ago.
Is this more, real quick, because we are up against it, is this more WNBA based right now with the NBA in the future, or is the NBA pretty intermediate right there too?
So, right. I mean, this is a much longer story. I think based on a few things that have happened in the last week or so, the talking point from Project B right now is they're trying to start a rival women's league. But if they are successful, and by successful, I mean, if they get a Caitlin Clark, if they get another massive WNBA superstar or a couple of them and pay them nine figures, trust me when I tell you that NBA players who are free agents in the summer of 2027, they're going to see that and they are going to be very interested.
Joe, always great stuff, man. Great to have you in studio here. Thank you so much for your time, bud.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Joe Vardon of The Athletic on the Fan Hotline. We will react to that and some of those comments there in the lead at 5. But we got Lindsay Rhodes of Sumer Sports coming up in 5 minutes. Did the Greg Newsom and Joe Flacco trade surprise her? And is this tanking? That's in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey friends, it's Ken Carmen
and Anthony Lima.
Did you know that the Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima is both a radio show and a podcast?
You can find us anytime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods.
Catch the full episode, listen by the hour, or jump straight to the highlights.
Just open up your favorite podcast app, search our names, and hit the follow button to get every minute of the show.
Your way and on your time.